What is nearly always most arresting in any ramble through the scattered disciplines of modern science is realizing how many people have been willing to devote lifetimes to the most sumptuously esoteric lines of inquiry. In one of his essays, Stephen Jay Gould notes how a hero of his named Henry Edward Crampton spent 50 years, from 1906 to his death in 1956, quietly studying a genus of land snails in Polynesia called Partula. Over and over, year after year, Crampton measured to the tiniest degree, to 8 decimal places, the whorls and arcs and gentle curves of numberless Partula, compiling the results into fastidiously detailed tables. A single line of text in a Crampton table could represent weeks of measurement and calculation. Only slightly less devoted, and certainly more unexpected, was Alfred C. Kinsey, who became famous for his studies of human sexuality in the 1940s and 1950s. But before his mind became filled with sex, so to speak, Kinsey was an entomologist, and a dogged one at that. In one expedition lasting 2 years, he hiked 2,500 miles to assemble a collection of 300,000 wasps. How many stings he collected along the way is not, alas, recorded. Something that had been puzzling me was the question of how you assured a chain of succession in these arcane fields. Clearly, there cannot be many institutions in the world that require or are prepared to support specialists in barnacles or Pacific snails. As we parted at the Natural History Museum in London, I asked Richard Forte how science ensures that when one person goes, there's someone ready to take his place. He chuckled rather heartily at my naivete. I'm afraid it's not as if we have substitutes sitting on the bench somewhere, waiting to be called in to play. When a specialist retires, or even more unfortunately, dies, that can bring a stop to things in that field, sometimes for a very long while. And I suppose that's why you value someone who spends 42 years studying a single species of plant, even if it doesn't produce anything terribly new. Precisely, he said. Precisely. And he really seemed to mean it. 24. Cells. It starts with a single cell. The first cell splits to become two, and the two become four, and so on. After just 47 doublings, you have 10,000 trillion cells in your body and are ready to spring forth as a human being. Actually, quite a lot of cells are lost in the process of development, so the number you emerge with is really just a guess. Depending on which source you consult, the number can vary by several orders of magnitude. The figure of 10,000 trillion, or quadrillion, is from Margulis and Sagan, 1986. And every one of those cells knows exactly what to do to preserve and nurture you from the moment of conception to your last breath. You have no secrets from your cells. They know far more about you than you do. Each one carries a copy of the complete genetic code, the instruction manual for your body, so it knows not only how to do its job, but every other job in the body. Never in your life will you have to remind a cell to keep an eye on its adenosine triphosphate levels, or to find a place for the extra squirt of folic acid that's just unexpectedly turned up. It will do that for you, and millions more things besides. Every cell in nature is a thing of wonder. Even the simplest are far beyond the limits of human ingenuity. To build the most basic yeast cell, for example, you would have to miniaturize about the same number of components as are found in a Boeing 777 jetliner and fit them into a sphere just 5 microns across. Then, somehow, you would have to persuade that sphere to reproduce. But yeast cells are as nothing compared with human cells, which are not just more varied and complicated, but vastly more fascinating because of their complex interactions. Your cells are a country of 10,000 trillion citizens, each devoted in some intensively specific way to your overall well-being. There isn't a thing they don't do for you. They let you feel pleasure and form thoughts. They enable you to stand and stretch and caper. When you eat, they extract the nutrients, distribute the energy, and carry off the wastes, all those things you learned about in junior high school biology. But they also remember to make you hungry in the first place, and reward you with a feeling of well-being afterwards, so that you won't forget to eat again. They keep your hair growing, your ears waxed, your brain quietly purring. They manage every corner of your being. They will jump to your defense the instant you are threatened. They will unhesitatingly die for you. Billions of them do so daily. And not once in all your years have you thanked even one of them. So let us take a moment now to regard them with the wonder and appreciation they deserve. We understand a little of how cells do the things they do, how they lay down fat, or manufacture insulin, or engage in many of the other acts necessary to maintain a complicated entity like yourself, but only a little. You have at least 200,000 different types of protein laboring away inside you, and so far we understand what no more than about 2% of them do. Others put the figure at more like 50%. It depends, apparently, on what you mean by understand. Surprises at the cellular level turn up all the time. In nature, nitric oxide is a formidable toxin and a common component of air pollution, so scientists were naturally a little surprised when, in the mid-1980s, they found it being produced in a curiously devoted manner in human cells. Its purpose was at first a mystery, but then scientists began to find it all over the place, controlling the flow of blood and the energy levels of cells, attacking cancers and other pathogens, regulating the sense of smell, even assisting in penile erections. It also explained why nitroglycerin, the well-known explosive, soothes the heart pain known as angina. It is converted into nitric oxide in the bloodstream, relaxing the muscle linings of vessels, allowing blood to flow more freely. In barely the space of a decade, this one gassy substance went from extraneous toxin to ubiquitous elixir. You possess some few hundred different types of cell, according to the Belgian biochemist Christian de Duve, and they vary enormously in size and shape, from nerve cells whose filaments can stretch to several feet, to tiny disc-shaped red blood cells, to the rod-shaped photocells that help to give us vision. They also come in a sumptuously wide range of sizes, nowhere more strikingly than at the moment of conception, when a single beating sperm confronts an egg 85,000 times bigger than it, which rather puts the notion of male conquest into perspective. On average, however, a human cell is about 20 microns wide. That is about 0.02 millimeter, which is too small to be seen, but roomy enough to hold thousands